This podcast is sponsored by Adelaide. You've probably heard of Adelaide by now. This month, they announced a new product, Adelaide for Publishers. For the first time, publishers can leverage attention metrics to curate inventory, deliver attention insights, and drive higher CPMs. Join The Weather Company, NPR, Westwood One, Cumulus Media, and other leading publishers taking advantage of the attention economy's most popular metric, AU. Maybe one day Mark will convince me to sell guaranteed AU slots on Marketecture, but probably not. Check out AdelaideMetrics.com/AFP for more information. All right, welcome to the Marketecture Podcast. I'm Ari Paparo. Eric is on vacation this week, which as a venture capitalist, I'm not sure is very different from his day-to-day life. So we have Mike Shields as our co-host. Mike, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Ari. Excited.
In addition to Mike, we have our special guest today, Rich Radden, the co-founder and co-CEO of Zephyr. And Rich is here to talk about politics and election advertising. Rich, thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks, Ari.
So quick promotions and housekeeping. So this week's Marketecture interview was really interesting. It was with PubMatic, so I recommend watching that before it goes behind the paywall. We heard a lot of interesting stuff they're working on that maybe you're not as familiar with. And I have to do a call out to Mike for his total troll bait of a newsletter this week. You should really subscribe to Next in Media. Mike's, what was the title of your newsletter?
Troll baiting? I don't know. I reject that. I just asked, should ad tech be rooting for Trump, a Trump win? You'd be surprised how many people didn't want to talk about the subject, by the way. But it's interesting, given all the regulation, would everybody be better off if that guy came back? I don't know.
Well, I guess we'll just be trafficking our ads from the concentration camps. So we'll find out. Nice job, Mike. Everyone subscribe to Next Media. Okay. So Rich, so I think people are pretty familiar with Zephyr. You want to give us kind of the elevator pitch on what you guys do so that people have familiarity?
Sure, yeah. We measure and target around safety and suitability in the walled gardens. The thing that's unusual about us is we only work in the walled gardens. We don't work on the open web. And the elevator pitch is obviously there's two big measurement providers out there that have built their businesses largely on the open web. And we thought that we could build something really interesting and unique and candidly more accurate in the walled gardens, which is a very challenging place to work in because of just the scale.
Yeah, absolutely. We wanted to have you on because we know you've been doing a lot of work on elections.
Yep.
And we're 5 months away, as we're joking earlier, from a really important election, a really divisive election. And we have AI and we have misinformation. We have a lot of things going on. So why don't you just level set for us with what you're seeing, what you're frightened of, how you're helping your customers, and just give us an introduction.
I'm an optimist, but I'm pretty frightened. I mean, this is the perfect storm, right? When OpenAI released their models, ChatGPT, to the world, and people recognized the power behind these LLMs, and then it was followed up by Google's release of Gemini, and obviously there's lots of others out there that are being released every day. It's the perfect storm, and coupled with the fact that we saw in 2016 how misinformation could really be, for lack of a better word, weaponized. By the way, there's good things that are happening in the world around combating misinformation, including better efforts by the platforms themselves, but it's pretty intense, and mostly because it's super effective. That's what the studies have found. Like, it actually works in swaying people's opinions. And so we're in a pretty critical year. It looks like a dead heat between two candidates. I can't imagine. There's a lot of foreign governments that have been involved in spreading misinformation previously. So we know that there are bad actors out there. And then the question is, and I can talk about all the good efforts that are being done, including what we're doing at Zephyr to a small degree, but all the great efforts that are being done to combat misinformation. It's pretty exciting.
Right. And so what is the current state of policy around this? I believe I read that Meta and Google are both restricting AI for political ads.
Correct.
I don't know how well they can afford that. How well could they enforce that?
Well, I think they can enforce that very well on the ads, advertising themselves, on the creative themselves. There's a policy in which they get to approve that. And they've been both these platforms have been forward leaning, including TikTok, of getting out in front of like the creation of content. That's not where we see a lot of the damage that can be done. It's not the official ad. It's actually, you know, people that are uploading these wild and crazy and unsubstantiated rumors and cloaking it in the mask of fact when actually it's fiction. And that, to, you know, when you talk about the amount of content that's uploaded to the social platforms, I think that's the stuff that's truly scary, especially because, you know, MIT did a study in 2018 that just, and it was a pretty in-depth study that showed the virality of misinformation. And there's something weird about us as humans, but for some reason, it's super viral. It gets shared more, it goes deeper, broader, you know, than actual truthful information. Something about the salacious nature. And actually, the MIT analysts studied, like, the more salacious the lie or mistruth was, actually, the more shareable it became, which that's where it starts getting into some really, really scary stuff.
I mean, look at the fervor around the Kate Middleton thing, which that wasn't just the usual wacky people passing around. That was almost everybody got into that and caught up in that. And that was as salacious as it gets. That's a little scary about how prone society is to that kind of thing.
Yeah, I do. I have this fun thing where, so we monitor misinformation. And we should talk about that, because the policy around misinformation that GARM has come out with needs, I believe, fine tuning to it. Like, for instance, GARM is Organization Global Alliance for Responsible Media, but they define misinformation as like things that are untrue, and like medium risk in misinformation is like in an entertainment concept. Well, that would be like, if you actually take that at face value, that's like half of Saturday Night Live, where they do things that are, it's parody, right? You know, like that's the definition of parody. So obviously there needs to be some fine tuning on how the definitions of how we define misinformation. And it's coupled with social issues, which gives everybody a little bit of an out. But we monitor misinformation, and it's so fun for me to go in when we see these huge spikes. I'm like, what was that? And typically somebody on our policy team can say like, oh, that's Congress is in front. There's a group of people in front of Congress testifying about like UFOs or whatever they call them now. And I'm like, you see a spike, right? And, you know, another one was obviously the Israel-Hamas war. We saw an enormous amount of misinformation, and it took the form of, you know, people uploading generative images that were just that were telling a different narrative. People were repurposing content, like video content from wars of like 5 years ago, and putting it out and saying, look what's happening in Israel. So it was pretty rampant. It's a never ending stream of this happening. I don't know if you guys, like, I can talk about the positives with positively happening in the ecosystem.
No, Eric's not here. I don't care about any positive shit.
Yeah, I don't know about positive. This is a podcast, man.
Exactly. Yeah, everyone's going to off themselves out of it. It's like, the world is doomed. But in 2015, it was clear there was an issue with misinformation. And it was detected first and foremost by journalists. And so a lot of journalists, the Poynter Foundation, which is based out of Florida, came forward and said, look, we should put together an organization, a fact-checking network. And they really started to explode. And a lot of them are NGOs and nonprofits, fact-checking networks. Actually, yesterday it was announced that Google gave the European fact-checking network. There's a international fact-checking network and a European fact-checking network. There's a lot of overlap between the two, but there's over 300 organizations that are spread all over the world in different countries, which is important, right? Because this year, you know, Planet of 7 Billion, there's elections that are gonna touch almost 3 billion people this year. So you need to have fact-checking organizations spread out throughout the world. And they do good work, and they don't get paid a lot, and it's literally for the good of humanity. But Google just announced they just opened up. They gave $1.5 million to the European fact-checking network, and they opened up a new database. They're calling it, actually, I wrote it down here, 24, shoot, what is it called? It's like Election 24 Readiness or something, where they're going to be populating that database for, you know, for the Google engineers, because we operate the same way. We need actual facts from verified sources, so that we can train our models to detect misinformation.
But isn't there like a velocity problem in that it's, I'm misquoting, but something like, you know, it takes 10 times as much effort to debunk BS as does to create BS.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, we're being candid with one another. The biggest problem with it is it's the velocity of content that's being uploaded and the nuances from which it drifts. So, and our data science team calls it drift. So you can start off with one mistruth, but they can evolve and shape shift into different forms of misinformation. And tracking that is a very, very challenging job.
Yeah.
And like I said, I think the platforms have really doubled down and are doing a better job. We're at Zephyr, look, we have a little bit easier job in that we're trying to do it on behalf of brands, so that we don't have to, you know, platform wide monitor everything. We're monitoring the stuff that brands are adjacent to or could be adjacent right to, which is a small subset.
Well, yeah, we'll get to that in one second. I just want to talk a little bit more about the content side. Yeah. So there's been this fun conversation around Shrimp Jesus.
Yeah.
I think they talked about it on the Hard Fork podcast as well. Basically, Shrimp Jesus is a Jesus made of shrimp and other crustaceans.
Yes.
Very popular on Meta, popular with your aunt. I'm sure she forwarded it to you.
Yeah.
But also, it's emblematic of this massive onslaught of AI-created images that seems to be proliferating on certain social networks.
Yeah.
Is that what you're seeing also?
Yeah. Yep. So the great thing about the LLMs is, candidly, is that like you're just left up to your imagination. You give it some prompts and you get back some really wild imagery. And synthetic images are hard to detect. We're training our algorithms to be able to do so. I know the platforms are doing it as well. The audio is super, super freaking challenging as well to detect. But that's when I call it a perfect storm. You know, the reality of it is it takes one really interesting post that's up for a short amount of time that gets viral really quick, that sways somebody that doesn't log in, that's not actively monitoring the information that's coming into their feed. You know, I often tell people, and I love my mother, she's awesome, but like my mother still partially believes Pizzagate. You know, she heard it. She's like, did you know there's a, you know, pizza parlor with a basement? And my mother's in her 80s and stuff. And we've sat down, we talked about it, but that's the power of this stuff, is that it can be, you know, wild. And now, and people are like, well, you can't fool my eyes. Well, actually you can now with the generative models, like you can. So that's where it's just like, it's a full onslaught.
What's going on with video and with YouTube?
So YouTube is being really proactive and they're saying, look, we're going to, as a creator, you need to proactively, and I think this is actually the path to victory on this, you need to proactively tag when you've created content with generative models. By the way, not only, it's also, it's a virtual circle because like that's just amazing training data, right, for them to actually to find the content that isn't being tagged. But they're doing that as well as Meta. Meta's saying, look, you need to proactively tag. And obviously, they create the incentive structure for the creators and the people that are uploading content. The LLMs are, I think, an incredible advancement. It's going to do incredible things for our society. It's just the bad actors that we have to be worried about. And then, so how can we build safeguards? And obviously, Sam Altman's talked about, like, we should have a secret watermark on everything we create that can be detected. We can give that code to each of the platforms so that it can be detected. But it's not just OpenAI that has these image models, right? Now there's like half a dozen companies that have it. And so it's gonna be a challenge.
It for our purposes, and I think somebody been where you were going, all right, is this much more of a tech problem than an advertising problem? Meaning, like for putting the candidates aside, the average brand, don't they just want to stay away from this stuff and just keep me, I don't want to fund it or be next to it, but it's not my problem to really fix these societal issues or stop AI from TikTok. Am I being too cynical? Is that kind of the way they view things?
Well, it's twofold. It's a good question. So first, you're right. They just want to be away from it. But detecting it is hugely important. But the other thing that's kind of crazy about this, and we saw this during the Israel Hamas, and we still see it today, unfortunately, is that you can actually feed these LLMs prompts to say, hey, take a take X product or the package of X product or this beverage, and I want you to wrap it in, I want you to douse it in red blood and have red blood spilling all over it. And then I want you to create a tagline like, we support so-and-so side or something.
Jesus.
And we're actually seeing that. Yeah, we're actually seeing where people are prompting models because they have a viewpoint. They say, this brand, you know, this coffee brand or this brand, this is doing this. And so like we're trying to help the brands that we work with navigate this because it's a very challenging thing to navigate because at a certain point, you know, Elon Musk is out there been talking about free speech and, you know, no censorship and stuff. So a lot of these brands don't want to be thrust in the limelight of like doing trademark violation. And we talk to the platforms about this, like, but so they don't want to actually become part of the conversation, but they're sort of unwillingly being thrown into the mix because of the ability to use logos and packaging and all sorts of things with generative models.
Yeah, I read that Starbucks has really gotten pulled into Israel, Hamas, and they don't want to be at all for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what do you do in that case? Is that something that that the brand can deal with, or is it more of a legal issue where they have to send cease and desists or take down when the brand is used that way?
Yeah, there is a path to do it. There's a path to do it. First of all, I think the easier path to do it is to work with the platforms to diminish the viewership and the virality of that, which they, as you know, Ari, they can absolutely do that. That's the path of least resistance. You can get a little bit more hardcore and just say it's copyright violation or it's trademark violation in most instances, and it can come down that way. It's just a question of like, you know, if it's not going to go viral and not going to be seen by a lot of people, do we want the future news about us pulling down some content if that then goes viral? So we're like in the midst of this right now. We're right on the forefront of working with our brand partners to decide what to do with it and to take action.
There's been this conversation that's been happening for a while about the verification companies blocking hard news and yep. about brands avoiding news. And then we had Adfontis Media here who has yeah. their kind of way of looking at the world.
Yep.
From what you're telling me after this, if I was listening to this podcast, I would say, oh my God, I don't want to be near anything political this year as a brand. Am I being short-sighted if I'd said that?
Well, I think so. I mean, I'm a fan of Adfontis and I love Lou Pascalis, and I think what they're doing is really good. And I believe in supporting hard news and accurate news. And so I disagree with Nandini, who came on to debate. Like, that was fun, by the way. But I just think, like, look, they have a structure. You might not agree with it. They look at bias left, right, and you can determine as an ad buyer where you want to be and what you want to support. I think that's important. I think the thing that we look at the world is that a lot of misinformation is created by unknown outlets, you know, not your typical sort of standard news outlets. And that can be much more damaging. In this, I referenced, there was a Pew Research piece that came out in 2019 that basically talked about the virality quotient. And a lot of stuff, it happens if, like, I'm friends with you, Ari, and you post something crazy and then Mike sees it. Mike might not know, like, I know Ari's crazy. I'm like, yeah, he's got all these like fantastical, but like Mike doesn't. And so because you're kind of connected in my network, like I'm going to listen to that. What I thought was fascinating is we did a study with, we're going to release the results just to talk about the damages of misinformation with IPG. And what was fascinating is when you're asking consumers about like where the most misinformation is, obviously number one was social media. But number two was television.
Interesting.
I was like, what? Like, that's the person. So clearly we live in a very like chaotic space where people are like, I don't know what to believe. I've been told not to believe. So to that point, like, I actually think that the supporting good news is hard news is a good thing. And that's why I think I applaud what Adfontis is doing.
Yeah. I think Ancient Aliens may have set back the veracity of television by a couple of decades.
yeah.
You know, there's actually this meme that the guy, you know, the guy, the Ancient Aliens with the hair, He actually looks enormously like Elon Musk if you remove his hair. And there's some people who are like, this is what Elon was doing before he started Tesla.
That's amazing. That's incredible.
I guess that one of the challenges is that it's easy for brands to say, I'm not going to be on a bunch of news sites because they're not that big anyway. But you can't avoid the platforms completely. And if they're going to be infiltrated with politics, that's going to be a hard choice to make. They kind of have to have some kind of safeguards, I would think.
Yeah. I mean, this is the reason we exist. Years ago, when I went to the board and said, we want to dive deep into the platforms around this kind of content. And we went out and we acquired a company 2 years ago in Israel that he'd been working on this problem for 5 years with his team and AdVerify. And that's what gave us the misinformation solution. But it's a challenging solution, and it's not for the faint of heart. Like, you get into some really squeamish conversations, mostly because people don't recognize there's bias. I know you guys don't think you're biased, but we're all biased. I live on the coast. We all have bias to us. And it's really about removing bias and getting to true facts. The number one question my mother asked me after we bought AdVerify is, I said, oh, you know, they get fact data. And she goes, well, who's giving them fact data? You know, that's kind of the place we're in right now. And at Zephyr, we try to get out of opinion and just go to sources, fact sources. And by the way, if we don't have that data yet, that's why COVID was so challenging, because the science was developing, let's be honest, right? There was a lot of unknowns. But thankfully, you can just bucket that and label that as social issues. So you get away with, like, saying, exposing some sort of bias, right? The other thing is, like, we're talking about elections and stuff, but misinformation is, like, it's crazy. It's like it spreads the gamut. I mean, tons of misinformation about aviation, tons of, like, obviously health and science and math. And, you know, if I would have told you 20 years ago that there'd be this whole thing about people that believe in flat Earth, you would have thought, like, that's crazy, right? But that's kind of where we're at with, you know, these public squares, these social platforms, in terms of it's a really powerful place to express yourself. Brands just have to be careful.
I want to follow up on this Ad Fontes question, because fundamentally Ad Fontes is saying that the bias is correlated with extremism, right? And you should avoid that. And you kind of just said the same thing in a sense. You said, like, we need to look for truth, we're all biased, et cetera. But why if you think of first principles, should a brand be scared of being in an opinionated, biased sort of environment? If it's not hateful, if it's not damaging, if it's just, like, right, you know, leans right, leans left.
Yeah, I don't, by the way, maybe they don't. And that's, I think, the beauty of what Ad Fontes is doing, but also the beauty of what, you know, we do at Zephyr is that we're saying, like, look, there's an actual architecture you can look at. Our policy team will work with you. You tell us what you want to stay away from. Like I said, the way GARM described misinformation as medium risk around entertainment, that's clearly, you know, parody can fall into that. It's like most brands would love to be around Saturday Night Live content, whether it's political or not. So the fact of the matter is about getting just the details with the brand. And that's ultimately where a third party can come in. Like I said, the platforms have a much harder job, especially the deplatforming stuff, I think, is a big call. Elon Musk has been very vocal about this. He's like, everybody should be able to say anything on my platform. But brands don't actually have to support that. But at a certain point, like, where does that world end? At some point, you kind of have to put some guardrails around it. And I think ultimately that platform, which we don't work on right now, but they just recruited over Yael Cohen, who is a big brand safety advocate. He knows the space very well. You know, hopefully there will be some guardrails placed on that platform. That give everybody more comfort, right?
Well, I hope Yael got a very nice severance package in this company.
I was just going to say the same thing.
So, on that note, all right, we're going to come back with the news of the week. A lot of really interesting news around the subjects we've been talking about. Let's take a quick break, and we're back. So the big news today, as we're recording on Thursday, is the Wall Street Journal published a report from Adalytics Research showing that Forbes.com, which ostensibly is considered a quality site, had a mirror version of the site at www.3.forbes.com, which was effectively an MFA version of the same content. So they would take an article on Forbes, which had, you know, a reasonable number of ads on it, and they would divide it into a 32-slide slideshow, each one of which had five ads around it. And this was all in some sort of devil's brew mixed with Outbrain. And it is quite a little situation. And as I'm going to quote my own tweet, which was, the shittiest site on the web secretly has an even shittier version. So brilliant.
Yeah. It's, I mean, look, it's shocking. I've been a vocal, fan of Christoph and Adalytics and what they're doing, just because I always feel like truth and transparency, like everybody needs to be transparent in this issue. The thing that I found kind of shocking is, and look, I'll take a second to take a little stab, but really a call to action. I'm trying to figure out how to do it politically correct. But the reality is there are verification vendors out there for the open web. And we don't operate in the open web. We operate in the walled gardens because it's very challenging. Looking through that report, there were pixels on every single one of those ads that appeared on that subdomain site. How did this go unrecognized for years? And right. To me, that's accountability, is saying, what as a brand or an agency are we paying for? And by the way, it doesn't mean that Zephyr doesn't make mistakes. We do. We make mistakes all the time. But you cannot, you got to dig in this stuff. And I think I appreciate the work he's doing to uncover this stuff. I think it's going to be an interesting can. What do you think? Like, it's kind of, by the way, the only thing that I didn't love about the article is I got a call today from a friend and I said, what do you think about that article? He said, well, you know, Wall Street Journal is the competitor of Forbes.
Oh, no.
So
see that?
And I'm like, holy shit, what? That's, come on, you're listening to the forest through the trees here. You know, like they shut it off as soon as the reporter called. You know, where there's smoke, there's fire on this thing. Let's go. So,
yeah, that reporter just speaking of somebody who used to work at the Journal, like, oh, you're not getting like any. First of all, the Forbes of today is not a threat to the Journal in any way, and you're not. It's not like that reporter is getting anything out of that business wise. It's just an awesome story. It's funny because I get most of my news from Forbes 3, and I feel like I'm pretty well informed. It's kind of a bummer to hear that someone's crapping on it, but I think it's you're dead on that the verification guys seem like they're really asleep on this. Analytics just running circles around everybody this year. The Forbes brand I thought couldn't fall any further. Like I remember I actually went on a Forbes yacht party and got a ride. People got rides in the helicopter. That's how high flying the brand was not that long ago, and now it's like become so laughable. It's sad. I wonder if anything's really going to happen here other than a bunch of brands are going to say, keep me away from Forbes, and that's about it.
Yeah, I have a couple of points I'll make. First point is, when the MFA thing Made for Advertising blew up about 2 months ago, we had Chris Kane on from Jounce, and he said this. He said, there are some mainstream brands that have subdomains that are filled with crap. He didn't say Forbes, but he knew this was happening. So that's the first thing. Second thing is, and I got into this a little bit on Twitter with somebody else, which is the verification companies don't verify that you're running good ads in good places. They verify very specific things, like, is it a spoof domain, which it was not. Is it viewable, which it was, because the site was all ads. They're not a overall quality protector. They're very specific things that they do, and I think it kind of points out the way brands should be thinking more holistically about where their ads are appearing instead of just relying on a pixel from somebody.
All right, I agree with that entirely, what you said. The difference is if you ask clients, brands, and agencies in market what they're getting, the value they're getting, they paint with a very wide brush. I've had to tell more than one client and agency, when we were first on measuring brand safety and suitability on Meta, I had to say, look, we're the only ones doing it right now. There'll be others coming along. And they're like, no, we get this from this provider, or that provider. I'm like, you're not. Like, I had to have the platform send them an email saying, yeah, they're not, we don't do that on that platform. So it is a matter of education. And I do think as CEOs, as company leaders, we can't, this is all about misinformation. We can't allow for the spread of misinformation within our own ecosystem. you know?
Right.
Where it's like, yeah, they think they're getting this, but they're actually getting this kind of thing. So,
yep. I agree entirely. While we're on the subject of quality, another thing that was talked about this week is that Google AdX is adopting the proper IAB labeling for their video content that they sell against. So the IAB clarified the way video content was supposed to be labeled so that the buyers have a better sense of it, whether it's in-stream or out-stream, and whether the content is made for advertising or not. Sort of. It's not really made for advertising. There's some, you should read the spec. I'm not going to go through it. Anyway, the important point is that AdX is starting to label it this week. And for people who know something about this, not including me, they think it's a big deal. So I had outreach from several people about this saying, oh my God, this could be huge. I'm going to read a anonymous quote from someone who is in the industry, someone I trust. Up until at least a year ago, probably 80% of what was bought as in-stream in programmatic was actually out-stream. That collapse of supply will be like the 1973 oil embargo. It's going to be quite a shakeup.
Yeah, good quote. I mean, look, I agree entirely. Exposing my bias, obviously, we work in the walled gardens. We've been on YouTube forever, and actually the scale of TikTok is growing like crazy. The scale of Meta video is growing like crazy. It was always strange to me when I met people that said they bought video off of the platforms at scale. I was like, where is that content? It's kind of like how I feel about connected TV when everybody talks about CTV inventory and all the massive amounts of inventory out there. I'm like, I don't think you're talking about YouTube TV's inventory or YouTube on the connected TV platform. So where is this enormous scale?
Yes.
And to me, it just reeks of like
the bazillions of views that are supposedly generated by the fast channels on Samsung or whatever that, like, I don't know anybody who watches that. Like, and this is very similar, like, but it's a little bit brand's fault here. Or whoever's buying this, it's the constant, like, I want more cheaper every quarter, but like, why are these CPMs so cheap for this video that, you know, it doesn't match up with anything else you can buy? There's got to be something wrong there, but it's a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, exactly.
So the expected result of this is that CPM should go up for quality inventory. CPMs, so talking to some sources, people think that the in-stream versus out-stream part is largely played out, that the out-stream has already felt this impact over the last couple of years. And the real impact's going to be on the sort of pseudo-content video players that take, like, the content of the page and turn it into audio or video and with the sound off. I would say good riddance to low-quality inventory. All right, so the big news of this week before the Forbes story was Kadant acquiring AdTheorent. So AdTheorent was a publicly traded ad tech company, basically a DSP, that was purchased, or the purchase price is $324 million versus $170 in trailing 12 months gross revenue. So, you know, approximately 2x gross revenue. I think the interesting angle here is, like, is ad tech M&A back? And that's what Ronan Shields at Digiday wrote this morning, that ad tech M&A is back with Vizio, Walmart, and this deal. We're going to start seeing some real excitement. Mike, you want to give your opinion here?
This is a wildly uninformed opinion. I mean, I would expect, if you're talking about ad tech acquisitions being back, I could see companies trying to match what Walmart did with Vizio specifically. Like, that was, I could see an arms race there. This is one of those ones I'm not as close to as other people. It was a little bit like, a lot of ad tech acquisitions for me, I read them, didn't that company already do with the thing that they're buying? That's kind of what I thought was going on here. Like the recent LiveRamp deal. Don't you have a clean room, but you bought a clean room? This one.
Yeah.
But this one, I wonder, it makes sense to me on paper, but is it going to be complicated in execution, in that do budgets get implemented this way where there's, you're trying to bring together performance advertising and local television and CTV overall, and that's like different people and budgets. I always see those complications, but maybe they're able to pull it off in a way that makes sense.
Yeah. Cadence is an interesting company, one of the more interesting scaled private companies. They're owned by private equity. They have a very big footprint in linear television. They're effectively a television ad network, and they've been making acquisitions. They acquired EMX out of bankruptcy, so they have a supply-side platform although I'm not clear how well they've been able to revive it post-bankruptcy. They had another DSP, and now this one. And Ethereum was a bit of a laggard on the public markets. Stock wasn't doing very well. It was not growing. One thing that I think should be noted is that Ethereum is mostly a managed service business. They say as much. So not really a self-service DSP. I think it's just wait and see. It should be interesting to see if anything develops out of that.
I was just going to say, you know, Terry Kawaj has talked about this. He's like, we're entering the great age of M&A and stuff. And I think there's two, like, that takes, yeah, he, of course, a banker saying that, amazing. Anyway, I love Terry. And by the way, that'll be all the talk at DMS this year, this spring.
It will.
But the thing is I think there's two forms that this takes, the M&A market. One is, you know, we went through a tough 23, right? The industry went through a tough 22 when interest rates were rising and ad spend was coming down and whatnot. And so it's companies that are just like, you know what? I don't think we've built anything really sustainable and that can go big and large. So let's just look for an escape hatch. And I feel like that's, it, to me, I don't know anything about the details, but it feels like they were really depressed in their stock, you know, and their stock price. And somebody came in opportunistically and said, we want some of this business and we're going to get it at a deal. So I think that's going to happen in 24 and 25 specifically. My hope is that the opposite happens as well. And Ari, you've been around. I mean, you're a pioneer in this business. You've seen when businesses, really strong, robust businesses have been built and they've sold for a lot of money. And so, you know, candidly, hopefully there'll be a lot of businesses that grow into that. And we see a resurgence of really meaningful value coming together for good prices.
Yeah, when's the Zephyr IPO happening?
Well, I hope soon. No, I don't, you know, who knows? But the reality of it is we actually have a plan of what we need to do and what we need to continue to get to. By the way, I remember you, at one of those dinners, I think you were at the dinner, actually. It was one of the dinners Terry hosted. One notable gentleman stood up, and it was during, like, when it was just booming, right, in 21 and 22. And he goes, guys, I've been around this industry a long time. We can't blow it like we've blown it before. Like, let's really use this opportunity to build meaningful value. And I was like, that is wild. Like, just from an outsider in this industry coming in and now being, you know, been a few years that we've been doing this, is that it's just wild to me that that's the temperament that, like, you have to remind people to be able to build really quality solutions as opposed to the easy, you know, it's got a huge TAM, this vertical, but don't take the easy path, build something that's really meaningful. And you've been around for that too, by the way.
Yeah, it's just a reminder how rocket fuel just screwed everybody over.
Exactly.
By going public.
Exactly.
You know, it's all their fault. Yeah. So, last thing I'll touch on is JIC news, my favorite subject. So AdExchanger reported that the TV JIC is going to certify ComScore and VideoAmp as national TV currencies ahead of the May upfronts. So that means that if the brand and the media company agree, they can run their campaigns using one of those two currencies instead of Nielsen. And this is as opposed to the running thought that there'll be dual currencies or supplemental currencies. It's worth noting that iSpot is also on track, but for a June timeframe. So I think this is just an incremental move. I don't think this is surprising, but it's sort of a big milestone that is going to happen for the upfronts. Mike, have you heard anything? You're pretty plugged into the TV world.
I feel like the sentiment, this feels like it's important, but maybe a little late for this upfront. I feel like, you know, it's they are already talking about deals, some of these companies. It's probably a little hard to scramble and get this, but it's not as though the networks haven't tested currency deals before the JIC certifications. Some of this happened. It just hasn't been half our inventory is going to be sold to VideoAmp now instead of Nielsen. Like, nothing like that's happened. It doesn't seem like that's going to happen that quickly as much as maybe people want. It's also gotta frustrate if you're not certified by the JIC at this point. Something going on. Or is it just everybody's going to get it eventually? I don't know.
By the way, I was just going to say, as a spectator, I'm fascinated by this. And truly, I don't have a dog in this fight at all. But it is fascinating to watch, mostly because Ross and VideoAmp, they raised so much money. And by the way, I thought the article, I don't know if it was in DigiDay where they wrote it, I thought this sums up, I need to get this quote printed and put a this on my wall where somebody was talking about, it's when they were talking about VideoAmp struggles, and somebody said, like, look, everybody said Nielsen's wrong. We came in with data, you know, this is somebody, you know, VideoAmp came in with data and they said, well, this doesn't look like our Nielsen data. And I'm like, you said this was wrong. And they're like, yeah, but it's not, you know. And I'm like, if that doesn't summarize the industry, like, everybody's been complaining forever. So I'm fascinated. I hope something comes from this, by the way, for VideoAmp or for any of the other measurement providers. I think innovation is good. Obviously, Nielsen's been at the top of this heap for a long time. I'd love to see the industry just embrace different methodologies and rally around it. I think it's good for innovation.
Yeah, I mean, what the customer actually wants is just Nielsen plus 1 point or two, you know? So just license the Nielsen data and mathematically add a little bit to every cross tab, and that would make everyone really happy.
Well, that would have saved a lot of VC funding right there, a lot of VC funding money. Ari has the answer. Just call Ari, 1-800-ARI, and he'll give you, just to add that plus one.
Yeah, I think, isn't there a thing called Nielsen Plus? Or it should be.
I think so.
All right, let's call it on that. This is a great conversation. Rich, thank you so much for sharing your insights.
Thanks, guys. Thanks, Ari. Thanks, Mike.
And Mike, thanks for filling in as a co-host for this week.
Thank you. Thank you both. This is fun.